This is the Nutters Club. Thanks to New Zealand On Air on News Talk ZB.
Good evening and welcome to the Nutters Club, the show where a psycho and a psychotherapist get to take on the airwaves for a couple of hours every Sunday night and Monday morning. I'm Hamish Coleman-Ross, probably the psycho of the two, and joining me, he's been absent for a wee while, don't know what happened, but clinical psychotherapist Kyle McDonald back in the studio. Kyle, welcome back, we missed you.
Yeah, kia ora.
I want to tell you that there were lots of texts, calls asking for your absence.
None.
Nothing.
No.
Nada. Not
that's fair
thing. But, you know, you're back now, and that's great.
I missed
great.
You.
Oh, thank you. Oh, you want me to say I missed you, don't you?
That'd be nice.
Okay, sure. All right, I missed you too.
Thanks, Hamish.
We did talk about you behind your back, though. It was all good, and you can listen to the replays to find out fully what was said. But the point is that while you've been away, you know, there's been a lot happen. We, of course, got some final tallies on the Gumboot Friday Fund, and we've talked about that in a few past episodes. But look, Gumboot Friday, and I know we've talked about it a lot on this show over the year, but there's been a bit of a milestone this week, right?
Yeah, so we hit 2,000 sessions that we have paid for, the 2,000 counselling sessions for under-19s. And, of course, with the addition of the Bryce Casey Spare Change Fund, we're now taking people up to 25. So if you're out there and you're under 25, and you want some counselling, get on gumbootfriday.com, check it out. It's so easy, people can't believe it.
And how easy is it? So, look, let's just put me in a scenario. Let's just say I'm a parent. I've got a young person in my life. He's 22, but worried. Haven't been to a counsellor before or a psychotherapist or whatever you guys want to call yourself this week. What do I do?
So, in New Zealand, any registered counsellor, registered psychotherapist or registered psychologist can access the fund by simply sending us an invoice. You can go on the gumbootfriday.com website and have a look at it. We've got a list of people who've signed up to be on our website, so you can pick someone from that list. But you can literally find anyone. If you've got a family recommendation, you've got a GP's recommendation, you can use that and just let the counsellor know. Just send us the invoice and we'll pay it. It's that easy.
Sounds too simple, Kyle.
I know, it does sound too simple, but it is actually that easy. We don't cap the number of sessions. We don't ask for a diagnosis. We don't ask for a doctor's referral. We just want to get people in front of a professional as quickly and easily as possible and pay the bill.
It sounds like this advert where you say, you know, send no money now. But yeah, it's like, don't send any money, because it's like, don't worry, because we'll do the sending of the money.
We don't give you any steak knives.
This is
just counselling.
Probably good, considering what we talk about on this show sometimes, Kyle. Steak knives might not be great. Anyway, it's really great to have you back, and it
Thank
has
you.
Been wonderful. Now, look, our guest tonight is really interesting guy, and I got given about three of his books by Boris to read, and Boris was our producer the other week, and I thought, no way I'm going to get through three of these books. And to be fair, they have been rollicking reads. The one that that I did get right through was his newest one, and it's called How to Sleep Better, Worry Less, and Feel Happier. Isn't that a great title for a book?
Yeah, I think you're halfway there with the book if you get the title right, and that sells itself, doesn't it?
His name, the author's name, is Dr. Girish Kanji, and he's in the studio with us now. Dr. Girish, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Hamish and Kyle.
Now, I love a book that, you know, kind of sells itself. And to be fair, How to Sleep Better, Worry Less, and Feel Happier, it kind of sells itself, to be fair. But your story on how you got there is why we've got you here tonight, and looking forward to getting to the point where we can talk about the book. But let's just get a little bit about you. Where are you from? Where did you grow up? Where did life kick off for Girish before you were a doctor?
I was born in Wellington Hospital and spent the first 50 years of my life in Wellington. So I went to school at Berrenpore School, South Wellington Intermediate, and attended Wellington College, went to Victoria University before I went down to Otago to do medicine. So I'm the son of immigrants. My parents came from Gujarat in India, and they came over in the 40s and 50s. And in fact, my father was the one who instilled studying in our household, and he was the first Indian man from India to graduate in New Zealand with an engineering degree in around 1953.
Wow, so did he go through Victoria for that?
He went through Canterbury.
Through Canterbury, yeah, I was going to say engineering, right. So he went through Canterbury. What was that like? You know, because there wasn't a huge Indian population in New Zealand in the 1950s, was there?
Well, there wasn't a huge population, and my daughter recently was doing a course, and she looked at her genogram. And after this, we started talking to relatives and uncles and aunts, and what we found out was my grandfather came in 1918 to New Zealand, approximately. And lots of grandfathers came out around the same time, including my wife's grandfather. But the woman didn't come till 1950. And so there's this really interesting period where my father, her father, and lots of boys around the age of 10 to 12 came to New Zealand, lived with their fathers who they'd never seen before. And in fact, they actually lost that mother figure for, you know, the good part of 10, 20 years. And so when I was growing up, one of the things, you know, we got a lot of education and it was promoted. We got a good pat on the back if we did well at school. And when things didn't go so well, there was probably the emotional communication wasn't quite there. And I didn't really realise how much this actually affected me growing up. And even in my communication with my own children, my wife, it was like, you know, there was financial support, there was, you know, love, but it was the language of emotion was actually quite something that's come on quite late in my life.
And so that was because of the absence of that mother figure.
I suspect it's a generational thing.
Yeah,
that,
right.
That, you know, there was a lot of love in the household.
Oh, sure, sure.
But it was just learning an emotional language, I suppose.
And so you then, because I know, you know, I've read this story, but you then had a very prominent event in your life very early on that really, you know, literally left its mark on you.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that. Yeah.
I was around 5 years old and I contracted tuberculosis. And so I went up to the Chest Hospital, which is the fever hospital in Mount Victoria. And I remember being there clearly. And in fact, the physician, the respiratory physician, was Dr. Peter Martin, who, when I went to med school, he was actually one of the lecturers there. And as a five-year-old, he kept telling me, oh, you'll be in for another 2 weeks. And for another 2 weeks, another 2 weeks. And it dragged on for 3 months. So I was in isolation for 3 months. And I didn't think much of it, but I've blocked out everything except a couple of events. The first one was my mum coming to visit me and bring some lunch and some love, and that was sort of, she'd come every day, and I owe my mum a lot, actually, because we were pretty poor. She had no vehicle, so she'd have to, I think she might have taken the bus to the bottom of Mount Vic and then walked up the hill. It's quite a big walk. And she used to do two jobs as well, so she'd go to work at 7 a.m., she'd come home at 3, and then she'd go to another job at 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. at night. So it was a lot of hard work, and, you know, bless her soul, but she certainly got me through that time. And not long after that, about a year later, I was involved in a car accident. And that put me back into Wellington Hospital, and I was there for 9 weeks in traction. And I remember a lot more about that hospital visit. I remember the nurses. There was a school teacher who'd bring a trolley of books around. I remember my best friend actually stayed in the hospital for tonsillitis in the children's ward for a night or two. And so there's a few more memories. It was a bit more pleasant. But after I left, soon after, I just developed lots of nightmares and night sweats. And this actually carried on pretty much till I was 40 years old.
And this is where you started to get your interest in pain medication, pain medicine, pain treatment?
I've sort of, when I was seven, I was at the dental clinic, and I remember with my mum, and the receptionist said, "Hey, what are you going to be when you grow up?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going to be a doctor." And so I'd sort of developed a fascination in my teenage years about how the body works. It's just something I was interested in. But really, it would turn into a study about how the body doesn't work and what goes wrong.
Well, let's take a break there. When we come back, we'll keep talking with you about what it is that you started to really delve into, and what you started finding some of your findings and trying new and different things. Back soon here on the Nutters Club.
Nutters Club. Now on News Talk ZB.
Welcome back to the show. My name's Hamish Coleman-Ross, and in the studio with me this evening, he's back, clinical psychotherapist Carl McDonald, and our guest tonight, Dr. Goresh Akanji. And Dr. Goresh is just telling us about, you know, life as a young man where he had tuberculosis, TB, and then a car accident. So, you know, you got to know the inside of hospitals fairly well over that time. And you know, this idea of having an interest in pain, were you in a lot of pain as a child, as a teenager?
As a child and teenager, I wasn't in a lot of physical pain. But there certainly was sort of insomnia, anxiety. There's a lot of irritability as well.
Did you know what to call it when you were a teenager? Because often we don't when we're young, do we? You know, it's quite hard to understand what's happening.
I think it's hard, and I think there's layers actually as well. So there's sort of, sometimes there's a deep layer of sort of a scared little boy, I suppose. But then you function. So you go to school, you know, you get good grades, you play a bit of sport. And so you sort of almost squash it. So it's at quite a deep level sometimes. And that, I don't know, that possibly is protective, allows you to function, but it's always there. And I think probably what happens is from time to time, it sort of can express itself more. And so then you might, you know, I don't know, behave a bit differently, act out and do the odd, behave like you might not normally behave.
So how did the insomnia and the anxiety impact you at your younger age?
It was bloody stroppy. At times, I think my brothers could attest to that. And I always felt life wasn't fair. It was a really weird feeling, but it's like, oh, geez, it's just not fair. And you've got your own point of view, and like that's the only point of view. And if something else happens, you've got this deep sense of unfairness. And I think that can, you may be more reactive.
A sense of injustice.
A sense of injustice, difficulty letting things go.
Sort of fighting reality.
I think you're fighting reality. And I actually, thinking back, I suspect my sense of reality was not reality, but my own view of it. And it's almost more strongly held. So you can't get a perception from another person. Mm. And I think I just remember, even, you know, for decades, being, if I didn't have a good night's sleep, I'd wake up and I'd be shockingly irritable, very angry at times, actually. And I do regret that a lot, but it's just the way things were. And sometimes if I was on holiday, I'd be a lot more relaxed and easier to communicate with. And I think, yeah, it was... I got through it, but I know now that life is just a lot easier for me, that what I feel underneath, my thoughts, emotions and actions are sort of at one, so there's no deep-seated fear or being scared anymore.
What was the motivation for you to pursue medicine as a career?
Look, I wanted basically to help people.
What with specifically? Was it general, or was there something you focused on?
Not at all. When I did medicine, it was really, I like to work out how things actually work, And so my interest was in, you know, how does human body work? And I think, like most doctors, we want to help people. We get people who come to see us. They've got problems. They may not know what to do about them. And I think on a deep level, we, you know, that's part of the job. Yeah.
So tell us, you went and studied medicine at Otago. And then what happened after that? Where did you go to after that? Where was your first residency?
Well, I came back to Wellington, and I was at Wellington Hospital for a couple of years doing my house surgeon years.
Which you knew very well already as a child.
Absolutely. It was...
Probably hadn't even been repainted, I imagine, since then.
It was actually quite grotty. Back in the 90s, it was the old hospital.
You found by the bed, you know, just where he'd carved it, like, Gresh was here. Back on the ward.
It was a very old hospital when I was there as a houseman and a med student as well. And it was pretty easy. I was at home, and home and hospital was actually only a couple of minutes away. So
great.
I'd sort of get up about 5 minutes before I had to be there, get dressed, take the car, get down there, and I'd go home for lunch. And sometimes I'd fall asleep after a nice warm lunch from Mum.
Nice. Sounds like you're living the life. So then, look, you were a GP for a while as well.
I did general practice for a decade.
Yep.
And it was a very good grounding, actually, because it taught you to talk to people, get their stories, and have a grounding in a variety of medicines, so a variety of medical conditions. So it didn't restrict your view to just one type of problem. And so it was a very good grounding in general medicine for me. And as I did that, I started a diploma in musculoskeletal medicine. And my interest was in pain. And I used to do acupuncture. I did a lot of courses in mobilization, manipulation, all sorts of sort of things related to chronic pain.
I want to ask you this, and I'll get you to answer it after the break. But when you were a GP, you know, what were some of the mental health issues that people were coming to you with? And I want to ask you, and we'll get you to answer it after the break, but was this the first time, and what sort of stuff were you telling them to do? Because I'm interested how this sort of played out back in the day, because I feel like it's got an impact on what you're doing now. So we'll get Dr. Goresh's answer to that straight after the break.
Nutters Club, now on Newstalk ZB.
Welcome back to the show. My name's Hamish Coleman-Ross, and in the studio with me right now, clinical psychotherapist Kyle McDonald and Dr. Goresh Akanji. And, you know, we say on the show here often, don't we? You know, when someone calls up and they say, look, I'm feeling this, or I've got a family member or a friend going through that, we say, first port of call, go see your GP. And I have actually always wondered, what's it like to be the GP on the other end? And somebody comes in and says, I'm feeling a bit nuts. You know, I mean, and obviously, you know, I could just, I'm just going to imagine it. This is how I imagined it would be. And so, Gresh, you can tell me if this is true or not, but I imagine you sit there and you try and keep a wise face and nod slowly and go, yes, well. And then what do you say? I mean, I know you're not going to tell us all the details, but, you know, what were some of the common things that people were presenting with for you?
I think the first rule of thumb is to listen. And sometimes we don't have the answers. Even when I was in general practice, we obviously didn't have the answers sometimes. And so the thing is, but sometimes people just talking to us and we listen, they'll start resolving some stuff themselves. And I think that's, you know, even with psychotherapy, it's the person who talks, gets it out, expresses it, and then they think, oh, okay, and they can see things a little clearer. I think for me, I remember a lot of cases in general practice, because a large percentage of general practice is about people who have insomnia, anxiety, depression, worries about things. And a lot of them were job related, I just remember. People basically would come in, the bosses, they're having some conflict at work, the bosses and backing them up, and it would become a huge cycle that almost every time they thought about work, they'd just get so anxious. And in terms of the power struggles, because they couldn't change the situation. And I do remember that situation cropping up a few times. And sometimes, in fact, the advice had to be, you just can't go to work. You really have to, if you don't have the power in this situation, sometimes you have to get out of the situation occasionally. You know, and that, I do remember that cropping up time and time again. And in fact, in one of my, in the masters I did a thesis on human resources about job satisfaction and employee commitment. And I think, and I'm an employer as well, and I think as an employer, we really have people's lives in our hands, so to speak, for a large part of their working day. So a lot of responsibility for the employer to look after employees in situations of conflict.
So that would have been really interesting, you know, having different people coming in, obviously, and they're coming to you, you know, normally you're sort of like, okay, you know, people come with the coughs, the colds, and, you know, the rashes and all that sort of stuff. And then to suddenly, you know, you have a, and you would have no idea, and suddenly you have that mental health aspect thrown into it as well. So when you finished up your GP work, was that still kind of rattling around in your head when you, because you went and studied pain specialty in New South Wales?
I did my Australasian Faculty of Musculoskeletal Medicine training in New Zealand.
Okay, yep.
And sat the papers here. And then I did spend some stints in Newcastle, Australia, to learn procedures. And basically, then I sort of gradually went out of general practice and then started working at the Southern Cross Hospital in Wellington, actually. And basically then full-time with people just with chronic pain conditions. And I do remember starting my chronic pain sort of specialty. And one of the things that struck me at the time was we'd sort of prescribe medicines, and, you know, some of the common ones might be amitriptyline and maybe some opioids, some other medications. And it struck me that people would just keep coming back, and I thought, wow, this is not really going so well. You know, people aren't really coming back. And I think for a pain specialist, you know, I sort of, it's a pain score that's important. Mm-hmm. If they're coming with a pain out of 6, 7 out of 10, it'd be nice to get that down to 3 or 4 or 0 if we can. And I was a little disillusioned, actually, at the tools in the toolbox to manage chronic pain.
So people were just turning up, they're saying, I'm in pain, you were prescribing them or administering some sort of treatment, usually drug-based?
Yeah, usually medications.
Yep.
I think I've always had a bent towards advising people to exercise and look after themselves as well. But I think really the main tools we're talking about are medications, injections. Yeah, and there's also, I think, for pains, psychological interventions, seeing a psychotherapist or psychiatrist or psychologist.
So you're seeing these people come back, this, and then you could quite clearly see they weren't getting better. When was it that you started thinking there might be a different way here? Because, you know, doctors usually, I mean, that's what you do. You prescribe things, right?
Yeah. Look, I actually started experimenting.
And, okay.
And part of, you know, I was actually vilified for it from some sectors of the medical community, but I remember one of the first things I thought of was people came with a lot of muscle tenderness with any pain. And I thought maybe some of the muscle tenderness is causing the pain. And so I actually started injecting anesthetic diluted with saline, which is salt water, and started treating some of the muscles. And weirdly, what happened was a percentage of these people got completely better. And there were some articles in the Dominion Post. There's 2 or 3 of them, in fact, of patients that had, you know, almost miraculously got better. And I remember one case in particular, and he was a really, really nice old guy, actually, and he had back pain for 10 years. And I remember his daughter had to live with him because he couldn't live by himself. And he had to have pain even while he was in the bank standing in line. He could hardly do that. He couldn't cook. He certainly didn't go for walks. And I treated him. And at the same time, he was, in fact, told by ACC that his pain was because he was old, pretty much, a degenerative condition.
Nothing we can do about it.
Nothing we can do about it. What actually happened was his pain completely went away, and he was standing at the review office saying that, actually, my pain's completely gone away. And he, you know, he could actually, he went back to work at a charity. He said, you know, from Wellington, he said, look, I could go and walk to Petone right now. And it's really interesting because he won the case. He got rid of his pain. His daughter went to live by herself, and so he ended up living on his own and managed quite well. And so there's a few other cases like that. And so that then got me really thinking about what exactly is going on here. And that actually led me directly to do my PhD.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Goresh's PhD and that, what the connection between the pain and our mental health really is. Back soon here on The Nutters Club.
This is The Nutters Club, thanks to New Zealand On Air on News Talk ZB.
Damn right. My name's Hamish Coleman-Ross. Carl McDonald's in the studio with me. He's our clinical psychotherapist. And our guest tonight, Dr. Goresh Ganji, who is just telling us about really how you stumbled upon starting to kind of reassess the treatments that you were administering. Doctor, tell us about the connection, as far as you see it, between pain and our mental health. You know, how interconnected is that, and how important is it to be able to address those things directly?
Well, there's a direct link, actually, between pain and mental health, in that pain is one of the drivers of stress chemicals. And so, especially with people with chronic pain, they've got pain every minute of every day. And basically, it distresses them. So that pain sends a signal to the brain, and then the brain basically releases the stress chemicals, and the body releases the stress chemicals. And this is why people with chronic pain end up often the same as people with chronic stress. They end up with insomnia, anxiety, depression, and then because of the poor sleep, they end up with fatigue and tiredness, inability to exercise, sometimes low motivation. And in fact, when I see a lot of these chronic pain sufferers, they often end up separated because it's very difficult to support someone who's unwell. And so, in fact, it's one of the sort of three or four things that drive stress chemicals.
So when you're talking about the stress chemicals and how this affects people, what are some of the ways that we can treat it? What, I mean, is it coming down to medication? Because if I have insomnia, I get one of those sleeping pills, little white rugby ball ones, right? That I take that. Is that what I do, Goresh? Is that's the thing to do, isn't it?
Absolutely. Look, I think as a doctor and as a person, we don't really want to throw everything away, and medications are one tool in our toolbox. And in fact, they're a very useful tool because A, they cost very little. B, they don't take any time. And C, they actually can help used in a rational fashion. So I'm certainly not someone who says, oh, no, it's no good to take sleeping tablets at all, or it's no good to take antidepressants at all. I don't think, you know, we've come a long way in treating disorders, and pharmaceuticals are certainly one tool in our toolbox. But they're not the only tool. And I particularly, my keen interest is in simple self-treatments that act at the source of the problem.
And what is the source?
Well, the source of lots of symptoms. Let's take insomnia, anxiety, depression. And this is described in my new book, Brain Connections. Basically, we're talking about electricity in the brain. That's a nice, simple way of looking at it. So we have different parts of your brain. Say one part that looks at sleep. We've got one part that looks at anxiety. panic attacks and anger. We've got another part of your brain that does memory, another part that does thinking. We've got a part of your brain that subserves pain. So, you know, what you could easily think about this is when you have pain, and let's say knee pain, I'm running along, I get some knee pain, the electricity goes from my knee up my spinal cord to my brain, to a part of my brain, which is called the sensory cortex, which actually subserves pain. And the light goes on, the electrical activity occurs, and we experience pain. So I like to think of things quite simply, that symptoms can be thought of as electricity in different parts of your brain. And really, it's about how does that electricity become generated? What generates it and drives it?
So if somebody is experiencing that sort of thing, what are practical things that they can do? Does it differ for each patient, or do you think that there are things that we should be doing ourselves more in sort of our day-to-day habits?
Look, I think we're all a little different in that we like different things. Some of us like. So there are habits that actually reduce stress brain activity, right? And they basically reduce the electricity in all the parts of our brain. And some of these habits, which I describe the doses and things in the book, are like yoga, tai chi, meditation, breathing, sauna, and exercise above 50% maximum heart rate. So something that gets you a little bit puffed. So those are the sort of habits that I basically advocate people do 3-4 times a week, and not just to get better over 2 or 3 months, but really for life.
Sauna's an interesting one. I'm a big fan of the sauna at the gym after a workout. Does that actually have some therapeutic benefits? Because I know it feels nice.
Absolutely. In fact, I rate saunas as probably number one on the list, actually.
Really? Because I've always loved the sauna.
So if it's number one on the list, can I go to the gym and skip the workout and just go straight to the sauna?
You probably can. Yeah. I do that occasionally.
Yeah.
I think the heat reduces stress chemicals, basically.
Right.
And think about the world. And I do a lot of reading all around the world in terms of what people experience in different parts of the globe. And look at Fiji. Basically, people are really relaxed. You know, no one really cares too much about what gets done when. Whereas you look at some of the colder countries and people are just a little tad uptight, perhaps.
Yeah, it must be very cold in Glasgow. That's all I'm going to say. Sorry to all our Glaswegian. But, you know, in Glasgow, you get off the train and ask for directions, and you see, people sound like they're going to kill you. You know, it's like, take a left and a right, and you'll find what you're looking for, man. And, you know, and you're just sitting there going, I thought that man was going to kill me.
Yeah.
Turns out he was actually being very helpful and doing a civic duty and helping a poor tourist. But again, colder climate. And you're absolutely right. We know those kind of people as being harder. I mean, look, I grew up down south, and I can tell you right now, you know, it's not, hey, bro, how are you? It's like, yeah, right, mate. Yeah, good, mate. Yeah, because it's cold. You know, haven't got it. So you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? We actually have so much of what's actually happening to us around us and our characters and our behaviour, but we don't always engage with it as much. And it's like, oh, Fijians, they just say buller all the time. And you're like, and here you are telling me, well, warmer climate actually is having a chemical effect to be able to de-stress us.
Look, absolutely. It's probably one of the more interesting, and people always ask me about the sauna, and I actually did a randomized control trial, a study of sauna for people with headache. And the participants in the trial had 24 out of 28 days headache in 4 weeks for 16-year average. So they were a group of people
that's really chronic
headaches, daily headaches for a long, long time. So we split them into two groups. One group went to the sauna 20 minutes, 3 times a week for 8 weeks. And basically half of that group were cured. And overall about the pain scores went down 40-50% in the sauna group. So it was a small trial. And it was a proof of concept trial that I did at the end of my PhD after the model that I looked at.
I want to chuck it out there now to you callers and listeners, because, look, I would love to hear any of you with your own pain story. You might actually be suffering from insomnia right now, and I'd love you to give us a call, 0800 80 10 80. Pick Dr. Goresh's mind while he's here. Let's put this man to work. He's only been practicing for, you know, what is it, 50 years?
No, not quite.
55. That's right. But look, give us a call. I would love to know what your pain story is. Have you found things that have worked for you? Have you trialed things? You know, are you someone that went on medication for a long time and then found that other kind of treatments, more holistic treatments, were working? Is it a balance of both? Would love your feedback on that or your questions. You've got one of the best experts in the country sitting here right now. All you got to do is pick up the phone, give us a call, 0800 80 10 80. We'll be back with your calls and more with our guest tonight here on The Nutters Club.
This is The Nutters Club, thanks to New Zealand On Air on News Talk ZB.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to go straight to your calls, actually, because, wow, you have really lit up the board tonight, and that's wonderful. Chris, good evening.
Yeah, hi, how are you doing?
Good, man. How are you?
Well, I suffer insomnia and incredibly stressful high levels of pain. And it's been going on for 8 years. I've had 8 operations on my feet over those 8 years at about 6 month intervals. And I take large quantities of drugs of various kinds and swap them around to try and find something that's more suitable. And I take large quantities of Zolpidem to try and get some sleep. And my sleep patterns are about 20 minutes and then I'm awake again and 20 minutes awake again. And I haven't been able to find anything that gets my pain level down, you know, to any sort of acceptable level. And I'm into my 9th year of it.
G'day, Chris. If I could just maybe ask you a few questions.
Yeah.
What's wrong with your feet?
I've had my MTP joints and my big toes fused. I've had 8 operations, 4 on each feet, and the fusings, unfortunately, have all gone wrong, and they've had to be plates and screws out, rebroken, plates and screws back. That's the carry-on. I've got a couple of broken drill bits in there that they can't get out. Not a lot of bone left to work with to screw anything to anymore. A little bit of a consequence of really bad advice in the beginning that has got progressively worse, you know, as the years have gone by.
Sure. Look, it sounds like you may have a bit of nerve damage in there, possibly, and I can't tell just on the radio. In terms of the medications, I do a lot of work in the medicinal cannabis space, and I've read all the trials and done a podcast on medicinal cannabis. If you've tried all the medicines in the toolbox to date, that certainly is a possibility. And for people with nerve pain, the studies show probably 40 to 45% of people may have a 30% reduction in pain. And the other really good side effect is that sleepiness is one of the top side effects of medicinal cannabis. Hence, that may be something worth a try to help you sleep a little better at night, and that may help some of your pain as well. Have you tried that, Chris?
Yeah, I've been about a year on CBD oil, and I don't think it works for me at all in any way.
CBD oil, there's basically 2 components to the medicinal cannabis. One is CBD and the other one is THC. And the studies with the combination are the ones that show effectiveness for chronic pain and neuropathic pain, not the CBD oil. So if you have CBD oil, about 5 in 100 people may get some benefit. With the CBD and THC mixtures, it's probably closer to 45%. So I would definitely look for the THC CBD mix rather than just the cannabidiol. That is unlikely to work for most people with your sort of pain.
Yeah, I haven't been able to get I suppose the best way to call it would be a legal source of CBD oil with any sort of THC content.
Yeah, it needs a specialist endorsement at the moment. I think this may change by the end of the year, possibly, where general practitioners can prescribe. However, who knows if that one goes through. But it probably does need you need to go to your general practitioner, I think, in the first instance, see if there's a specialist in the area that's willing to endorse it, and that's probably the thing to do.
Thanks very much for the call, Chris, and some good advice there. Kyle, you might actually be able to tell us something about this as well, because you've been quite hot on this topic.
It's important to make the distinction between the cannabis referendum that's coming up next year, which is about legalising all forms of cannabis for consumption, which may be recreational, may be medicinal, from medicinal products, which are currently going through, there's currently bill going through the House looking at how they're going to operationalise that, because actually there's a strong commitment to medical access separate to the referendum. And there are a huge range of products now coming out of the states in particular that are all sorts of compounds and mixtures and percentages that show all sorts of therapeutic benefits. So put aside the referendum, we're actually just talking about medicinal uses, and hopefully, as you say, hopefully that'll come through later this
year. Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, look, we're going to keep Dr. Goresh here to talk to you. So if you want to get your call in, call us 0800 80 10 80. We're going to get a new sport and weather now. Back soon here with you on the Nutters Club.
This is the Nutters Club, thanks to New Zealand On Air on News Talk ZB.